The headlines this hour. Moscow bans the British Prime Minister and 12 other political figures from entering Russia. Response to, quote, British government's hostile actions. Israel's latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque prompts a flurry of reactions from governments, people, and organizations around the globe. Also, Shanghai reports a record number of symptomatic COVID-19 cases, while other areas across China impose restrictions amid attempts to stamp out the Omicron variant. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is BNews. Thanks for joining us. Russia has banned 13 current and former British officials, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, from entering the country over the UK's, quote, unprecedented hostile actions. The Foreign Ministry says the decision is particularly in retaliation for the UK's sanctions against Russian officials over the war in Ukraine. It says that London has launched an information and political campaign to isolate Russia internationally and to strangle its economy. Moscow accuses the UK of deliberately aggravating the situation in Ukraine by sending deadly weapons and pushing its allies and other countries to impose large-scale sanctions against Russia. Moscow's entry blacklist also includes Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, the Defense Secretary Ben Wallace, and former Prime Minister Theresa May. In March, Moscow imposed a similar ban against U.S. President Joe Biden. It's day 52 of the Russia-Ukraine war, and here are the latest developments. Russia says that it's hit more than 800 military targets overnight, including some 40 command posts. It also struck an armored vehicle plant in the capital Kyiv and a military repair facility in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Russia says its air defenses have shut down a Ukrainian Su-25 jet in the Kharkiv region. Meanwhile, pro-Russian forces in the eastern Luhansk region say the Ukrainian military has repeatedly shelled settlements there over the past 24 hours. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on his allies to quickly supply the weapons that he wants. He said the sooner Ukraine gets the weapons, the sooner there will be peace. Russia has already warned of unpredictable consequences if the West sends more arms to Ukraine. International reactions are pouring in over Israel's violations, including its assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Al-Quds. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has called on the international community to force Israel to end the aggression. Palestinians say the aggression amounts to declaration of war, urging international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Turkey, Iraq, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have strongly condemned the raid, saying that Tel Aviv must be held to account. Lebanon's parliament speaker has hailed Palestinians' resistance. Nabi Berri says the occupation of Palestine will soon come to an end. Lebanon's Hezbollah has also strongly denounced the storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the, quote, barbaric attack against worshippers. It says the invasion was a serious violation of the sanctity of the holy site. Jordanians also hit the streets of the capital Amman in solidarity with Palestinians. The protesters gathered near the Israeli embassy waving Palestinian flags. Yemen's Ansar movement has also denounced the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and hailed Palestinian steadfastness. Meanwhile, the UN chief has voiced grave concerns over the situation in Al-Quds, urging Israeli and Palestinian leaders to avoid further escalation. The European Union has called for an immediate end to violence in Al-Quds. Germany, France, Italy, and Spain have issued a joint statement expressing concern but falling short of condemning Israel's assault. Russia, however, has slammed Israeli actions, criticizing the regime for turning the Gaza Strip into, quote, a prison under open sky. Moscow has also blasted what it called the illegal occupation and the creeping annexation of the Palestinian territories. And Israel's main backer, the U.S., says it is deeply concerned about the latest escalation and has urged all sides to exercise restraint. Pro-Palestine activist Charlotte Kate says the Israeli attack on Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque is a horrific act against all Palestinian people as a whole.
It's absolutely a horrific attack on the Palestinian people and on Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and on the Palestinian people as a whole. This is a site that is sacred, that is respected by all Palestinians. And so it's a very deliberate attempt by a colonial state, by a colonial power, to attack people who are engaged in worship, who are engaged in prayer, and who are saying that Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be destroyed, will not be undermined. You know, there has been an attempt by the same regime to stir up the most racist, extreme Zionist settlers to engage in, you know, the slaughtering of sacrifices at Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to essentially create a desecration, in order to create a false view of what's happening in Palestine, as if this is a struggle between religions rather than what it is, a fight for people against colonialism, against a Zionist regime, a project that is supported by U.S. imperialism, by the European Union, by Canada, by the United Kingdom, in order to undermine and seize and control Palestinian land and resources. And this includes the attack on holy sites that are very sacred to Muslims, to Christians, and to the Palestinian people as a whole.
China's commercial hub, Shanghai, has reported a record number of symptomatic coronavirus. The city registered 3,500 symptomatic and nearly 20,000 asymptomatic cases on Friday. Shanghai's COVID case tally makes up the vast majority of cases nationwide, even as most of its 25 million residents remain under lockdown. Other areas across China are also imposing restrictions. Authorities are urging residents to avoid unnecessary trips outside and are encouraging employees to work from home. Vehicles have been banned from traveling, unless with special permission. Infections have been rising despite lockdown measures. China has implemented a strict zero-COVID policy aimed at eradicating transmissions. The policy has severely impacted the supply chain and goods distribution. Tehran has decried Britain's announced plan to force asylum seekers residing in the country into migrating to Rwanda. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the move means the UK is shirking its international responsibilities and obligations and passing the buck to a third country. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the move is also in violation of asylum seekers' rights stipulated in relevant conventions and human rights treaties. Britain announced its plan on Thursday to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda for processing and settlement there. The British government says it aims to tackle people smuggling and to fix its broken asylum system, but opposition politicians and human rights defenders have branded it as inhumane. The UN also said the plan raises human rights concerns. Lee Jasper is a race and equalities activist who joins us from London. Ian Williams is a journalist, analyst, and writer who joins us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Lee Jasper, let me first start with you. The explanation given by the UK government is that we're going to send them there because we want to process them there and have them live there. Do you buy that, just the justification that the UK is explaining?
No, because it flies in the face of the offer of President Macron to have offshore processing facilities based in Calais in France. And so this makes no sense. It's a huge attempt at political diversion. Prime Minister is in a very deep hole in relation to him breaking the law along with other senior members of the cabinet. And in order to divert attention away from those recently released news that the Prime Minister is facing a number of fines as a consequence of breaking lockdown rules, we've had this bizarre and left-field announcement. It's a means of trying to exploit racist sentiment that their government thinks is abroad, but which I think actually has been somewhat overturned of late by great compassion and sympathy for Ukraine refugees. And he's completely tone deaf to the needs of the country, notwithstanding the horrific effect it will have on those seeking asylum themselves.
Ian Williams, some of the criticism leveled against the UK Prime Minister treating people like commodities and saying these are neocolonial aspirations, amongst others. How do you view it?
It's a typical piece of upper-class British callousness to try to persuade people to do different. The aim of this is to dissuade refugees from trying to come to Britain because they might end up in the middle of Africa And I must point out, everyone seems to have forgotten, that Rwanda, with which Britain has such a cozy relationship now, has actually been indicted over and over for human rights failings, assassinates its opponents at home and abroad, actually sends assassination teams into other countries to kill political opponents of Paul Kagame, the current president. So it's not just any old country. And also it follows a pattern. The Australians did this with Nauru. Nauru, in case you forget, is a small coral atoll that mostly composed of bird droppings, seabird droppings, that was mined out for fertilizer. It's in the middle of the Pacific, and the Australians lent on the government of Nauru to accept refugees under the same conditions. People trying to get to Australia were put onto this desolate, waterless coral atoll and dropped down there. And the old British principle here is least eligibility. The idea is that you dissuade people from asking for government help by making the help so unpalatable that no one will take it. I'm sure it's in breach of international human rights conventions, it's in contravention of refugee conventions, and like your previous speaker said, it's almost certainly Boris Johnson's attempt to divert attention from his own political predicament. And we might add here that this follows in a whole load of Boris Johnson's grandiose schemes that never came through. If you look at the cost of this, the cost of shipping a refugee from Britain to Rwanda, processing them there, and then presumably bringing them back or finding somewhere else if they're passed, is tremendous, far, far more than sort of putting them up in a five-star hotel if they landed in Britain. So it's not about the cost, it's the idea is to make it punitive and unwelcoming. And it really shows what a nasty, callous bunch this government is in Britain.
All right, let's take a listen to some of the social media posts on this before we get back to our conversation here. Our first post: this survey omits to make it clear that sending to Rwanda for processing is in fact forced migration. Any successful asylum seeker has to live in Rwanda, not the UK. In summary, take vulnerable people and sell them. This is what the UK has become. Shameful. The next post: Rwanda deal will end up with more people trafficking. It's expensive and probably illegal. The UK has net negative migration, crops rotting in fields, not enough healthcare workers, etc. But don't allow asylum seekers to work yet. 3/4 of applications are successful. It's cruel. Next post: UK has small population and only 6 crore. It needs more people to keep its economic growth for long run. So migration should be welcomed always. All people should not be sent to Rwanda, except dangerous one. British people deserve no moral relief from the evil Rwanda schemes created in their names, whilst they fail to acknowledge that migration to the UK is an inevitable consequence of the poverty and wars propagated by the governments that they elect and on which their own wealth depends. And our final post: there is no such thing as an illegal asylum claim. It is legal to seek asylum by any and every possible means. There are no real safe routes to claim asylum in the UK, and they do not have to claim it in the first country. This sickening plan is illegal and immoral. Well, looking at the social media post there, Lee Jasper, obviously nothing was positive about that. And I'm curious as to why the UK feels it okay for this to take place and occur, but yet if they're Ukrainian refugees or migrants, that's fine, they could settle in the UK.
Well, there's always been an implicit understanding that British immigration policy is a cipher for race and ethnicity and religion. And white Christian refugees have always had a more sympathetic reception than your Muslim or African or Middle Eastern peoples. And that reflects the implicit, the structural racism and the cultural racism that is so prevalent in the United Kingdom today. But, you know, this is a massive distraction, because Boris Johnson knows very well that he will probably be challenged in the High Court, and that this legislation will be tied up for years. So it's really a sort of a high-profile announcement that stands very little chance of success. but what it's predicated on is the understanding that racism and racist immigration policies are assumed to play so well in the country. And it's trying to offer that red meat, if you like, for the hardcore Brexit supporters that Boris is getting tough on immigration. But he knows very well that it's illegal under international law, as already been stated, and the likelihood that he's going to be tied up for years in court. But he doesn't really mind that, because his objective is to cause division in the community, in the country, at a time of the most profound cost of living crisis, runaway inflation, and a prime minister who breaks the law. And he, like a trapped rat, is trying to find any which way to distract attention from the political and economic crisis that he and his Tories have brought about.
Hey, Williams, final question to you. You talk about how this is so expensive, that they'd probably be less expensive if they were put up in a five-star hotel. Aren't there employee or staff shortages that they can be used in whatever sector or whatever field? Because usually migrants, many of them end up in, well, one of the reasons they get the jobs is the jobs that many people don't want. So they can, you know, perhaps get placed there. Why isn't there a focus on that aspect of it?
Because we're dealing with prejudice and appeals to prejudice that Boris Johnson is trying to evoke. He is trying to scratch the thin skin of the Nigel Farage Little Englanders in the bar rooms and get them fulminating. And his attempt is all he needs. He doesn't have to succeed. He just has to be seen to be attempting it to get those votes. And more to the point, to get those votes off his back when they accuse him of backsliding. I mean, this is very cynical politics.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much for that. Ian Williams, journalist, analyst and writer from New York. Lee Jasper, thank you. Race and equalities activist from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The real threat against the U.S. is that of detached politicians who are amassing wealth, fighting for power and prestige, while their countrymen and women continue to go hungry, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. Here's the story. Mainstream U.S. media continues to celebrate the supposed strength of the U.S. economy. Almost daily, headlines speak of hopeful numbers, sustainable growth, positive trends, and constant gains. The reality on the ground, however, tells of something entirely different, which raises the question, are Americans being lied to, and for what purpose? U.S. economy grew 1.7% in fourth quarter, capping a strong year, the New York Times reported. U.S. economy grew 5.7% in 2021, fastest full-year clip, the Washington Post added. Reuters, Voice of America, The Financial Times, CNN, Market Watch, and many others all concurred. But if that is the case, why then is U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating at an all-out-time low? And why are many Americans literally going hungry? In a national opinion poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos and published on February 3rd, only 41% of U.S. adults approved of Biden's performance in office. A whopping 56% disapproved. The numbers were not a complete shock, as the downward trajectory of the Biden presidency has been in effect soon after he moved to the White House over a year ago. The truth is, Biden was not the Democrats' top choice nominee for president. Judging by various opinion polls and the early results of the Democratic primaries in 2020, it was Bernie Sanders who represented the Democratic hope for real, substantive change. Party politics, liberal media insistence that Sanders was not electable, and fear-mongering regarding a second Trump term in office pushed Biden through the ranks of nominees to be presented as America's only hope for salvation. While Republicans remain committed to Donald Trump's legacy and are still largely politically and ideologically united, Democrats are growingly unconfident in their leadership and uncertain regarding the future of their democracy, governance, and economy. Of course, they are blameless in holding such views. While the Democratic leadership continues to obsess with its fear of Trump, and while liberal media insists that the U.S. economy is as healthy as it can be, the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Here are some of sobering numbers. 56% of all Americans cannot produce a meager $1,000 as an emergency expense from their existing savings, CNBC reported. 1 in 10 U.S. adults have gone hungry last December as a result of poverty, Forbes.com reported. Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy revealed that child poverty rate in the United States stands at 17%, one of the highest among developed countries. If American workers are studied separately from the larger population, the numbers are even more grim. 3/4 of American workers said that it was very or somewhat difficult to make ends meet, according to a study conducted by Shift Project and reported in NBC News Online. 40% of the polled workers said they're not able to come up with $400 in emergency money. But the most shocking of all, according to the same study, is that around 20% said they went hungry because they shouldn't and couldn't afford enough to eat. Aside from occasional government handouts, which were provided by both the Trump and Biden administrations, little has been done by way of structural changes to the U.S. economy that would ensure greater equality among all sectors of society. Instead, the administration's priorities seem to be allocated to something else entirely. Writing in Politico, David Siders describes the current political discourse within Democratic Party circles where Democrats are losing their minds over 2024. Since the Democratic president's public approval ratings are dismal, Democrats fear the return of Trump. All anyone can talk about is Trump, donors, policy folks, party insiders, and the media. Siders quoted a Democratic advisor as saying the same advisor described a weird cycle where the conversation keeps coming back to Trump. Whether conscious of this obsession or not, the Biden administration seems to operate entirely according to a political strategy that is predicated on tarnishing Trump and his supporters, retelling over and over again the story of the January 6th insurrection, hoping for a Republican split or any other miracle that would bolster their chances of maintaining their congressional majority in the next November amid term elections. While doing so, the Democratic leadership seems oblivious to the harsh reality on the ground, where food prices are skyrocketing and where inflation has reached unbearable levels. According to new data released on February 10th by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7.5% in January compared to the same month a year ago, making it the fastest annual pace since 1982, the Financial Times reported. The rise in inflation is not a one-time off event, as CPI has been rising at a sustainable level of 0.6% on a monthly basis. Ordinary people can feel this increase almost every time they go shopping. Small business owners, especially restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores, are left with one out of two options, either increasing their prices or shutting down completely. Consequently, large segments of the already vulnerable U.S. population are growing more desperate than ever. To avoid providing real answers to difficult questions about the welfare of millions of Americans, about the real function of their democratic institutions, and about existing corruption within the U.S. political system, regardless of who controls the Congress or resides in the White House, Democrats and their media are either blaming their Republican rivals or creating foreign policy distractions.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
We express our gratitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for being able to come this far in the month of Ramadan and to be able to experience the 15th night of the month of Ramadan, which is the night of the birth of Imam al-Mujtaba salamullah alayhi, our second beloved Imam, the first grandson of the Prophet, the first grandchild of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, as-sibt al-akbar, the Imam who has led us in a very critical time in our development as the ummah of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. We ask Allah first and foremost by the right of this Imam and by the right of this occasion that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala relieves us of the difficulties and hardships of the pandemic. Imam al-Mujtaba salamullahi alayhi deserves a lot more attention in terms of covering him, his words, his leadership during the 10 critical and crucial years of imamah that Imam al-Mujtaba had after the shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen salawatullah wa salamu alayhi. And his seerah and his sunnah, which is the sunnah of the Prophet manifesting during that period those conditions. Imam al-Mujtaba had various factors to deal with. The people that he had to lead, he was the imam. And he was the imam for all, not only those who identified as Shi'atu Ahlul Bayt, not only those who aligned themselves with Amir al-Mu'mineen after Uthman, not only those that understood the imamah of the imam, who were very few actually, the ones who really understood the concept of imamah in Islam and the true khilafah of the Prophet, there were very few. Imam al-Mujtaba is not the imam of those very few. He is their imam, but he's also the imam of the ummah of the Prophet. All those who've accepted Islam, he has a responsibility to guide them towards Allah. And if then with that, that's a very large population, Imam al-Mujtaba's time would be consumed with them. If there would be an opportunity outside of that, to have spread Islam beyond the borders of Islam, then there would have been a responsibility, which that never occurred. Perhaps some non-Muslims that were still around, Christians, Jews, Majus in parts of current-day Iran and Iraq, there were still the remains of the Persian Empire in current-day Iraq and Iran. And so some people might have been still Majus at the time. Perhaps, but then in terms of expanding the borders of the Islamic country or the Muslim country, that was something that obviously he was not able to do, as the conditions weren't right for him to do that. But the people that were within the borders of the Islamic Empire or the Muslim state, they were various in terms of their abilities, in terms of their beliefs, in terms of their understanding, in terms of the influences on them. There was a lot of misinformation that was being circulated officially by Muawiyah before the martyrdom of Amir al-Mu'mineen, spreading lies, rumors, was one of the techniques used by Muawiyah la'natullah alayh against Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the people, unfortunately, even his the people that had pledged allegiance to him, they fell prey to that, they were influenced by that. And so there wasn't as much support towards the end of the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen as there were at the beginning of his khilafah. It's only a matter of about 5 years that we're talking about here. But in the initial days and first couple of years, there was more support. And eventually, towards the last year or so of the reign of Amir al-Mu'mineen, there was less support. That was in many ways due to, it wasn't the only element, but one of the serious factors was the lies that were being spread and circulated by Muawiyah and the people that he paid to circulate that misinformation in Kufa, in Basra, in Egypt, anywhere they could get their people there and to spread that misinformation. After the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen, all of what they had against the Ahlul Bayt increased multifold. Now, Muawiyah is officially ruling over the entirety of the Islamic Empire. So the sermons on Fridays in Mecca, in Medina, they are appointed, the person who will be delivering them, they will be appointed by Muawiyah. The message they deliver to the people is going to be aligned with Muawiyah's wants and desires, and that obviously meant that it's going to be against the Ahlul Bayt. Not only against the direction of the Ahlul Bayt, it would be against specifically Ali ibn Abi Talib, the companions of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and the direction, of course, that Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi, led people towards. But the attack was against Ali ibn Abi Talib, and of course his heir to his reign, or the wasi of Ali ibn Abi Talib, which is Imam al-Mujtaba, salamullah alayhi. There was a lot of that going on. Imam al-Mujtaba did many things in order to lead. One of the things he had to do was to deal with this misinformation that's being spread. There wasn't too much that the Imam could do by himself. He perhaps presented a model, a way of taught whoever wants to follow that. He taught them a method of dealing with this. So he did it personally, and whoever saw that, if they followed him, if they saw him as the Imam, or if we see him today as our Imam, we should follow that process, or follow that way, those instructions that he practically performed and showed us that this is how you deal with this propaganda against the truth, the slander against the leaders, the true leaders.
Dear listeners of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, you can follow this program entitled Minbar every day in the month of Ramadan. If you have any suggestion, you can send us your email at englishradio@irib.ir.
Love is everywhere, so much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran, I feel it inside me, strengthening my iman. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Critics say the enormous electricity consumption needed to sustain cryptocurrency is fueling the climate crisis and now threatens a partial resurrection of coal in the United States. We now present you an article written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled Bitcoin Miners Revived a Dying Coal Plant in United States. Then CO2 emissions soared. Environmentalists in Montana called it the death watch. Following years of financial losses, one of the handful of remaining coal-fired power plants in the state appeared doomed. Its likely fate offering a small but noteworthy victory in an effort to avoid disastrous climate change. But then a Bitcoin mining company stepped in to resurrect it. The Hardin Generating Station, a 115-megawatt coal plant located a dozen miles from the historic site of the famous Battle of Little Bighorn in southern Montana, was slated for closure in 2018 due to a lack of customers, only to somehow limp on, operating on just 46 days in 2020. Anne Hedges, co-director of the Montana Environmental Information Center, said, "We were just waiting for this thing to die. They were struggling and looking to close. It was on the brink, and then this cryptocurrency company came along." In a deal stuck in late 2020, Marathon, a Bitcoin mining company, became the sole recipient of the power station's electricity. It established an elongated data center on 20 acres of land besides the facility that is packed with more than 30,000 Antminer S19 units, a specialized computer that mines for Bitcoin. Such thirst for power is common in crypto. Globally, Bitcoin mining consumes more electricity than Norway, a country of 5.3 million people. As the Bitcoin miners moved in last year, Hardin roared back to life. In the first 9 months of 2021 alone, the plant's boilers fired up on 236 separate days. Planet heating CO2 emissions from the burning of Hardin's coal soared too, with 187,000 tons of carbon dioxide emitted in the second quarter of last year, more than a 5,000% more than was expelled in the same period in 2020. The Environmental Protection Agency EPA data shows in the third quarter a further 206,000 tons of carbon dioxide were emitted, a 905% increase on 2020. Marathon said in a December update, Hardin was operating at near full capacity, with the data center producing around 34 bitcoins on 1st of December. Hedges, who took to visiting the plant and photographing the new data center as it took shape, fans perched on its roof to help cool the humming computer hardware, said, "I was horrified to see it all happen. It was a terrible turn of events," adding, "This isn't helping old ladies from freezing to death. It's to enrich a few people with destroying our climate for all of us. If you're concerned about climate change, you should have nothing to do with cryptocurrency. It's a disaster for the climate." Hardin is part of a wave of America's zombie fossil fuel plants that have been brought back from the dead by cryptocurrency companies looking to feed the insatiable energy demands of their mining operations. China, formerly the epicenter of the Bitcoin industry, effectively banished around half of the world's currency miners last year, and the resulting search for cheap power has been companies eyeing struggling US power stations. In 2020, a mothballed coal plant in upstate New York was converted to run on gas and power a large-scale Bitcoin mining operation, a move that owner Greenwich Generation said is bringing a piece of the world's digital future to the state. Eric Adams, the New York City mayor, who said he would accept his first paycheck in Bitcoin, recently criticized the environmental impact of crypto mining. Meanwhile, in western Pennsylvania, thousands of Bitcoin mining computers have been packed in shipping containers alongside the Scrubgrass plant, which burns waste coal and was set to close before pivoting to Bitcoin. And in Kentucky, and new Bitcoin facilities being built next to the Big Rivers Electric Corporation, which owns and operates 4 coal-fired power plants. Cryptocurrency firms claim this tactic generates local jobs. Kentucky aimed to lure currency miners by passing a law that exempts them from an electricity sales tax and uses up excess power without straining the grid for homes and businesses. But critics point out that the enormous electricity consumption needed to sustain the virtual currency is fueling the climate crisis and now threatens a partial resurrection of the coal industry in the United States. Benjamin Jones, a specialist in natural resources economics at the University of New Mexico, said, "Coal and natural gas power plants used for crypto mining that would otherwise be sunsetting as we decarbonize adds yet more carbon to the atmosphere in an era when we should be cutting such emissions." Benjamin Jones added, "Cryptocurrencies' continued or expanding use of fossil fuel-sourced electricity imposes significant environmental economic costs on society." Benjamin Jones said, "It is troubling to see that Bitcoin's already huge energy consumption is increasing and that most of this is coming from fossil fuels, despite some efforts by mining companies to increase the amount of clean energy they use. Marathon, the company that draws power from Hardin, has struck a separate agreement in Texas to take power from a wind farm. Even some early champions of Bitcoin have balked at its energy use, with Elon Musk last year halting Tesla's use of cryptocurrency because he claimed the electric vehicle company is concerned about rapidly increasing use of fossil fuels for Bitcoin mining and transactions, especially coal, which has the worst emissions of any fuel. Uber, the ride-hailing service, has claimed it won't accept crypto payments until the climate impacts of cryptocurrency are reduced. A little more than a decade ago, it was possible to mine bitcoins with a single computer at home, using a negligible amount of electricity. The ultimate supply of bitcoins was limited, and new bitcoins were awarded to those who could help validate transactions, the miners. The process of validation essentially involves playing a giant guessing game that gets more difficult and more miners as more miners participate. As interest in Bitcoin has soared, fast, powerful computers packed in warehouses now have a better chance of winning the guessing game and being rewarded with several Bitcoins, which are currently worth around $42,000 each. This race for Bitcoin wealth gobbles up an enormous amount of electricity, around 0.5% of total global electricity consumption. The energy used to mine Bitcoin every 60 seconds would be enough to power the average American household for 17 years, while the annual electricity consumption for mining would be able to power all kettles used to boil water for tea in Britain for 28 years. While this usage has been criticized by climate activists, Bitcoin miners claim it should be put in a different context. Fred Thiel, chief executive of Marathon, said the movement of physical goods around the world and even the use of washing machines in the United States uses more energy than Bitcoin. He said in an interview, "I understand the desire for some people to point Bitcoin mining as a big bad boy, but in a comparison with every other industry out there, it's insignificant." Fred Thiel likens Bitcoin mining to the transactions processed in data centers by companies such as Amazon and Google, and claimed that the industry is moving quickly towards renewable energy. Marathon plans to phase out its use of coal next year, after finding its options were limited when miners had to quickly shift away from China. Fred Thiel added, "Go back to 2020, renewable companies weren't offering energy to Bitcoin miners." He added, very few people wanted to even deal with Bitcoin miners in the energy world, and so Bitcoin miners spent time looking for stranded assets. And so the only way for us to mine was to find stranded energy, which we did in finding the Hardin plant. It remains to be seen if Bitcoin will make a significant move away from fossil fuels, but in the meantime it will likely come under increasing scrutiny over its appetite for fossil fuel-powered electricity. Jones, the University of New Mexico professor, added, "We simply don't know how emissions from Bitcoin mining will look in 5 to 10 years from now," adding, "though it seems likely it will, to continue to be a major consumer of energy going forward."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. There is a well-known sentence in the Commander of Faithful's letter to Malik al-Ashtar. Imam Ali Salam tells him to employ people with such and such characteristics. He mentions certain qualities and says that Malik must choose, as his colleagues, people with those qualities. After mentioning those qualities, he says, "You should have a piercing eye in this matter, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons." This is astonishing. The Commander of the Faithful says this to Malik al-Ashtar 20 plus years after the Holy Prophet's demise. This is a reference to the domination of Bani Umayyad and the like. They were people who would pronounce morning prayers with 4-6 rak'ats instead of 2, and after that, they would say, "We were well, we feel great, If you wish, we can even say longer prayers for you. They are the manifestation of this, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When action was taken according to passion and worldly wealth was sought, such individuals use religion as a tool for achieving wealth and realizing their selfish desires. We, whether ourselves or our people, seek shelter in God, the Exalted, and ask Him to protect us from these hard snares set by the Satan. I hope that we ourselves will listen to this advice first, and that it will influence others as well. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make this month a blessed month for the entire Islamic Ummah and for the dear Iranian nation. Dear God, make the holy heart of the Imam of the Age satisfied and pleased with us. Help us benefit from the prayers and the satisfaction of the great personality, and send our greetings and regards to him as well. Greetings be upon you, and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.